Good morning. So, last time we talked mostly about single instruction, multiple data instructions. And these were a way our hardware could expose more arithmetic per instruction. Typically, the idea was we could just make our ALUs bigger, but all the other instruction handling logic, which it turns out is a lot of what our processor does, ended up being basically the same. So we just got a whole lot more computation done with the same amount of control logic, just by making our ALUs wider and our registers wider. And we talked about the interface to access this kind of directly that Intel proposed for using these from C, using these things with horrible names beginning with an underscore or two and MM typically, that you could use when your compiler couldn't figure out to use these single instruction, multiple data instructions, these vector instructions, the other name we use for them, which we learned happens probably more often than we'd like because it's often hard for the compiler to know enough about what you're doing to generate these instructions and know that it's safe to do so because of things like aliasing. And then we went on to our next topic, which was about exceptions, but we started with probably the most important use case for exceptions, which is sharing a CPU. So we have a processor, we want to run multiple programs on a typical desktop or laptop, you have like 20 applications open, they all seem to be running at the same time, you probably don't have 20 cores. How do we make that happen? And the answer is we switch between them, and the CPU needs to do things to help us do that. And the way we decided to divide up the work is that the OS is responsible for switching the state on the CPU, which we call the context, between different programs. And the OS gets run to do that with this mechanism called exceptions, where the processor, you know, even though there's no instruction telling it to do so, starts running the OS. So the OS can decide, do I want to keep running this program? Do I want to run another program? And so on. And we'll talk more about exceptions and other use cases today, and this concept of a process, which is what we think of as a program running on a machine. You know, that doesn't quite correspond to what owns the CPU since the OS decides to switch between programs. So any questions about any of this before I move on to today's topics? Okay, so first some logistics. So the final will be in Wilson 402, assuming I copy the room number right. Hopefully I actually did. Yes, Wilson 402. If you can't make the final for any reason, you better tell us really soon or else we may not be able to accommodate you. There's a conflict form I sent an announcement out about. It's linked on the website on the schedule where the final is. Please try to do that like today because I'd like to schedule all the rooms I need and so on for anyone who needs an alternate final soon. And as usual, note that when I say a conflict, generally I mean a real conflict, not like I want to go home early. So also, a note about the lab this week. So the lab this week uses SIMD stuff. It's a kind of a preview for the smooth homework. There are some optional parts of the lab based on how far we found that people got last semester. There's basically sort of a dichotomy. Some people get really stuck on the SIMD stuff and it takes them a while. Some people get it pretty quickly and they can do more stuff. We encourage you to, you know, try to, you know, do the optional stuff, at least start it, because it should make you more comfortable on the smooth homework, and obviously we can like give you much better help on the lab. Like we can, you know, eventually we can show you a solution tomorrow, which can't really do for the smooth homework. Also a note on smooth. So I know some of you find rotate pretty easy, like the first or second thing you try just works. Some of you it doesn't work quite that way. This is not likely to happen for Smooth. So Smooth, it's clearer what you're supposed to do, but it takes most students a lot longer. So please start early, especially start early if you're one of those people who thinks, gosh, this lab was really hard to understand, because you're doing the same stuff and, you know, with probably less guidance. So that's logistics. So last time we finished up talking about, talking about context switches. So we mentioned that basically the idea was that when we had multiple programs running, which I've called processes here, we'll see what I mean by that in a second. The idea is that the OS stores the state of every program which is conceptually running, but not actually on the CPU right now. And the OS just swaps that state it's storing in memory with the state that it's storing on the CPU. And the sort of pseudocode for this looks something like this. Obviously, this is not real assembly. And there's a question of, like, what does this instruction actually look like? We need some special instruction to, like, get the PC, because otherwise, you know, we can't look at our current PC that's in the OS, so that needs to be saved somehow. So there's some extra processor support that's not directly suggested here that we're going to need. So let's talk about the other aspect of processes. So we talked about programs, we have this context, and this is the list of things I said were in the context. We had the register values, including the stack pointer, the condition codes, and the program counter. And notably missing from here is memory. Like, I just don't have memory listed down. And that makes sense, because if you want to switch between programs and you like have a 100 megabyte array in memory, probably don't want to be copying that 100 megabyte array somewhere out of memory and back in each time we switch, given that when we're switching, we're doing it like on the order of every millisecond or something like that. So given that, let's talk about this example here. So if I have a program that I run, and I, in my program, have the value 42 at some address, and at some point I load that constant 42 into a register, and in some other program I just decide, okay, I'm going to load 99 to that same address. What do we expect to happen here? If I'm running these two programs simultaneously, and let's say it happens that the way I run these is that, you know, while we're here, we context switch to program B, the OS starts running program B, and then somewhere around here, we context switch back to program A. We swap the registers that are active on the CPU. So what, given either, you know, what I've explained before, or your knowledge of what happens when you run programs, what do you expect to happen if I try this on a real machine? Yeah. Yeah, so if things work just as I told you, we would just swap these registers, and it would end up that, you know, our program B would access program A's memory, which has that address, 10,000, and change the value there, and we'd end up reading that value in program A. And so if we did the simple thing where things work that way, that would be what happens. Now, this is not, in fact, what most modern systems implement. We have something extra going on that isn't essential to a context switch, but that means that these programs are more separated. So on the lab machines, if you actually try to run this program and make it like actually compile by turning X10,000 into a real label, you'll find out that program A will always give 42. That will somehow do some extra work to hide what program B is doing from you. That we're doing something special to do that. And in program B, it's because we're not letting you modify program A's memory that either it might crash, or it will do something, or it might just, you know, work and not tell you anything, but not affect program A. So even though the effect we expect based on what I've told you happens, and if context switches work the way I just told you, is that we get 99 in program A. That isn't what's going to happen on most real OSs because we're doing some extra stuff. And that extra stuff is related to what we've seen from our program memory layout. So you may remember me showing you this typical layout on Linux of our program memory, where we've decided that I'm going to choose this address, and I'm going to keep my code there, and then I'm going to put my global variables and so on. And this means that if I have two programs, this is what the memory layouts look like next to each other. But these are both on the memory at the same time. I told you in my context switch, I'm not switching out the memory. And assuming I'm not actually doing that, and I told you it would be really expensive, that means it seems like we have program A's code and program B's code at the same address. And that's clearly not actually possible. And the reason why, you know, that modifying address 10,000 won't affect the other program is related to how we let these two programs run simultaneously, even though it seems like that they have different code at the same address, like, which we can't physically do. And the answer is that the processor is going to support an additional mechanism that the book calls an address space. So you can think of the context switch idea as giving the program the illusion that they own the CPU. They change all the visible state on the CPU, and they can't see what other programs do to it besides through like time. In the same way, we're going to give programs the illusion that they own all the memory, that they can decide, I'm going to have something at this address, and it's going to be what I want to put there. And it doesn't matter what other programs are running, that's going to be mine. But that can't really be true because other programs are going to make the same decision. And the solution is that whenever program A accesses an address, we're actually going to go through this mapping. So we're going to add a layer of indirection here where we're going to take all the addresses in program A, both addresses where we access variables, data, and addresses where we access code, and we're going to put them through this mapping and use that to decide where in the real memory we access the values. And the same for program B. And this mapping is going to be set by the operating system. And the operating system is going to choose this mapping usually so it doesn't overlap. And that's how we're going to keep program B from affecting program A. That program B might have something at address 10,000, but because it goes through this mapping, there's going to be no way for it to overlap with what program A is in the typical way the OS sets up this mapping. The OS could set up the mapping so they do overlap, but it probably won't, because that's not how we write our programs. And there's some other attributes of this address space that are notable. So another thing on this picture is I have these big regions which are holes. And you probably remember from like writing C that when you access memory that's not you're not supposed to access, you get a segmentation fault. And that's what these holes are. These holes are, if I touch this memory, I get a seg fault. And that's also part of this mapping. So another part of this mapping is the OS can say that some addresses, instead of accessing some data in real memory, should trigger an error. That's another thing they can set as the mapping for an address. So we're going to talk about what this mapping looks like as our topic after exceptions, which hopefully we'll start a little bit today. And this is called virtual memory. The name virtual memory comes, most notably manifests is because we call these addresses here virtual addresses, and we call these addresses here physical addresses. So virtual memory is the type of addresses the program sees. And the mapping we're going to choose is something called page tables. So the mapping isn't as flexible as this might imagine. this picture might make you imagine. This, you might think the mapping is like a function the OS defines. It's going to be more restrained than that, so we can implement this efficiently. But this is what the OS is going to set up, and this gives us the illusion that that each of our programs have their own memory. As far as the program is concerned, their memory is just the things they can touch through this mapping. Anything else doesn't exist. And because the OS sets the mapping, the OS can choose to have the programs have whatever addresses they like, even if they're consumed by other programs or the OS itself in the real memory. And the mapping is going to be part of what we change in the context switch. So we're going to somehow save this mapping and restore it as part of our context. So our context is going to contain our register values, our condition codes, our program counter, all the Y86 state you imagine. And we're also going to change the memory, but we're not going to actually copy all the program's memory somewhere and then copy it back. Instead, we're just going to set this mapping as part of changing the context. We're going to change it from program A's mapping to program B's mapping and vice versa when we switch between program A and B. So when we combine these two things, we get what's known as a process. So a process is a thread, which is the illusion you have your own CPU. So this is what we get from time sharing the CPU. And an address space. So the address space is the illusion of your own memory, and this is what we get from mapping program addresses to real ones. So these two mechanisms combined together create what we know as a process. And this is what you think of when you say, I'm running a program on a machine that is like shared between other users. You don't get real access to the machine. You get access to this fake machine, which looks like the physical machine does, except the OS decides when you get to use the CPU. You don't get it all the time like you would in a real machine. And the OS decides what parts of the memory you get to use. You don't get to use all the memory that's physically connected. But as far as you're concerned, it's just like you have a CPU that's a little slower, but it's still a CPU. You have a memory that has a slightly different layout and is a little smaller, but it's still like you have a memory. So you can think of the process as being a little machine for your program that looks like a sort of mini clone of the real machine. And the OS gets to decide how close that clone is to the real machine, what attributes it shares with the real machine. So any questions about this idea of a process? Okay, so that was my diversion into what a process is. So we're going to talk a bit about exceptions specifically. And exceptions are, most notably for processes, the reason that we switch between programs, and also the mechanism by which our OS gets to do pretty much anything. Because if we don't have exceptions, there's actually going to be no reason for our OS to run. There's not going to be a way for our OS to run, especially if whatever program we're running doesn't have a reason to start the OS. Like if our program just is doing some computation, exceptions are the only reason the OS gets to do something. So we're going to talk about what circumstances do we want to stop what a program is doing and run the OS. And there's going to be two kinds of exceptions by our book's categorization we're going to talk about, where are going to be cases where we're running a program and for some reason we want to run the OS and have the OS decide what to do. So one category we're going to use is synchronous exceptions. And these are things triggered by a particular instruction. So one example is that idea of triggering an error. When we trigger an error, well, we shouldn't just keep running the program because we can't. We can't just keep running the thing which triggered that error because we can't give it a value from its memory access. It's going to just return a bogus value. So we have to do something, and what the processor is going to do is it's going to run the OS and ask the OS, hey OS, this program just tried to access memory you told me it shouldn't. I looked up the address, you should access it. It was trigger an error, here's your error, you figure out what to do about the program. So that's what's called faults. And there's other kinds of synchronous things where processes explicitly ask for the OS's help for some reason. And we'll talk about why that's necessary in a bit. So these are triggered by a particular instruction where the processor decides, I don't know what to do, I'm going to ask the OS how to implement this instruction, basically. There's also asynchronous exceptions. So these are things that come from outside the program. And we saw that with the case I started out with, where I had this infinite loop and I was timing how long each iteration took. And in that case, you know, the program didn't do anything. All the instructions it are executing executed normally, but we decided after a while that we should stop running the program and run something else. So this is our program, behaved normally, but the OS, for one reason or another, wanted to run something else. So our book has these four categories. I'm not the biggest fan of the book's categories, mostly for the last one. The first three you will see defined pretty much everywhere. The last one we're gonna kind of gloss over, mostly because it's not really well defined. If they like look at processor manuals, they don't always distinguish it from the others. So the first category we're gonna call interrupts. So this is gonna be anything externally triggered. And we've seen probably the most important, most common kind of interrupt already, which is this timer interrupt. And the idea of a timer interrupt is that conceptually external to our CPU, we have this timer device. We have like an alarm clock that the processor can send some signals to and configure. And the OS, except when it runs your program, it configures this alarm clock and says, make the alarm clock, give me an alarm, you know, in 5 milliseconds. And when the alarm clock goes off, it sends a signal to the CPU, and that signal triggers an exception. So the CPU says, well, I could keep running this instruction, but I have this alarm clock signal telling me, run the OS, please. So I'm going to run the OS, tell the OS, hey, your alarm clock went off, what do you want to do about it? And so that's the typical mechanism operating systems use to ensure that if you write an infinite loop, and I want to run a program too, it actually runs. As we'll discuss in a bit, there's another important kind of interrupts, which is for IO. And we'll look at what that timeline looks like. So I talked about faults. So I mentioned that faults, the most common one that you've seen, is the one which where your shell displays the message segmentation fault. And what's happening is that you did something where you accessed memory that wasn't in your address space, which was had the mapping said trigger an error if the program tries to use this. And the operating system got that. And what it decided to do was, OK, I'm going to context switch away from this program. And I don't know how to keep executing that program. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to get rid of the program and tell the thing that ran it, hey, your thing caused a segmentation fault and I didn't know what to do. Your shell gets that message and it prints out, hey, segmentation fault happened. There are other cases where we have faults. So another one of them is divide by zero. So on Linux, if you do a divide by zero, typically this manifests as a floating point exception, even for an integer divide, because someone made some bad choices. But what's happening is that the Linux operating system gets the divide error exception. And its handler for that says, I don't know what to do with this program. I'm just going to you know, get rid of it, and it tells your shell, okay, this program finished with some sort of arithmetic exception, and for some reason they called all of the arithmetic exceptions floating point exceptions, even though the most common one isn't one, is actually an integer divide exception. Another example is an invalid instruction. So, like in our Y86 processor, we set the stat signal to like halt the processor on an invalid instruction. That's not what you want to do in a real processor, because if a program has an invalid instruction it executes, you don't want to kill the whole machine. That would be pretty unnice. So instead, we're going to tell the OS, hey, this program tried to execute an invalid instruction. I don't know what to do. And typically, the OS's action is going to be just like with the segmentation fault. Let's context switch away from the program, get rid of all that stuff that it was using, and tell the thing which started it, hey, your program triggered an invalid instruction. You figure it out. So we have a third category here called traps. And these are intentionally triggered exceptions. And by intentionally triggered, I mean not in the sense that I wrote code I knew segfaulted, in the sense that there are some operation whose only purpose is triggering an exception. So for example, most processors have an instruction whose only thing it can do is cause an exception. And this is used to implement what are known as system calls. And this is where we ask the operating system, hey, please do something for me, this program. And we'll talk in a bit why we don't just use a function call to do that, which as far as what we've said so far, it seems like we could do. But there's a reason that we're going to need this special mechanism with extra processor support to go into the OS rather than using a function call. And I'm going to go through an example of probably the most common use case for system calls as far as frequency, and also I/O interrupts. And that's, let's say I have a program which needs to read input. So I'm running a program where I read a line of input. So what I'm going to do in that program is I have my readInput.exe. And I'm going to need to ask the OS, hey, operating system, I'm trying to read input. Generally, we're not going to let programs directly talk to things like the keyboard. They're always going to go through the operating system. So they're going to ask the operating system, hey, I want to read from the keyboard. Please, will you let me read from the keyboard? And they're going to do that with this intentionally triggered exception to start writing the operating system code, which is a system call. In this case, we said it's a read system call, read from the keyboard. So the OS starts running, and what it's going to do is says, okay, you're reading from the keyboard. I don't have any keyboard input right now. So I'm going to run something else while you're waiting for the keyboard to do something. So the OS switches to another program. Maybe in the middle of that, a timer interrupt happens, and it switches to yet another program. And eventually, I, the user, press a key on my keyboard. And this is a case where we want to run the thing which asks, please read from the keyboard, pretty much as soon as possible. Otherwise, I could wait who knows how long to know that that key press did something. So in the hardware, to help the OS do that, rather than have the OS like stop the program every like microsecond and say, ask the keyboard, hey, do you have some input for me? The keyboard is gonna send the signal to the processor saying, I have input, please tell the OS. And the processor is gonna turn that into an interrupt. It's gonna trigger an exception and just start running the OS right away in the middle of whatever program was running. Just like the timer interrupt, we're gonna say, hey OS, you get to decide what to do, but I think you might want to do something now. So the OS, in this case, it gets that interrupt from the keyboard, and it figures out, okay, the keyboard has input. Do I have any programs which care about that? And the OS is going to have some data structure where it kept track of, oh, someone asked to read from the keyboard before. And it's going to use that and say, okay, I should switch to this program which was trying to read from the keyboard now, rather than whatever was running. So this is the typical procedure for dealing with something like input. And note that by using this interrupt idea that we've prevented ourselves from wasting all this time while we were waiting for keyboard input, we actually got to run useful programs if we had any to run. Yes?
Is there a queue of like multiple programs that are all waiting for input, or is it only one?
So the question is there a queue of multiple programs that are all waiting for input? So this depends on the OS design. So one sensible choice would be to say, I don't really want multiple things to read from the keyboard. That's a pretty common choice for the keyboard, because you know, if I press the key, I probably want it to go to one program, not multiple. So that's probably what happens for the keyboard. For other devices, it's more complicated. So for something like a hard drive, multiple things want to read from a hard drive. And the OS probably needs to decide which one to do in what order and all that. And that is indeed a thing where it will have some sort of queuing. And this is something which is a, you know, could be quite a complicated topic to talk about in an OS class. But yeah, I started with the keyboard case partly because hopefully you don't have multiple programs which are allowed to read from the keyboard at the same time, because then you have to answer the question, if I type ls enter, what reads the l, what reads the s, what reads the enter? And we don't really want to answer that question. Okay, so that's an example of these interrupts. So these interrupts are typically coming from some sort of I/O device, like from a keyboard saying, I have a key press that you might be interested in, OS. And the OS gets that information and uses it to decide what programs should I run, what programs should I tell about this key press. And the same thing is true for like a hard drive. The hard drive says, you asked me to start reading something earlier. Here's the data I just read, OS. Why don't you send it to the program which cares about it? And it uses an interrupt to do that. Same thing with like a network. So like my Wi-Fi adapter says, I have this network packet that came in from some remote machine OS. Why don't you figure out what program was interested in it and let it know about that? And this is all done with interrupts. So the OS can just spend all its time letting programs run until there's something interesting for the programs that are waiting for input to handle. So the final category used by our book is aborts. So this is the sketchy category that if you read some processor manuals, some of them won't have it. But what our books mean by this is basically that something went wrong in the hardware. That it wasn't that you wrote a program that divided by zero. It's like the hardware is broken. So a classic case of this is that some memory can detect when there is an integrity error. So some memory has some extra bits in it to detect when bits are flipped randomly from, say, the memory being broken or some environmental effect like radiation. And when this happens, they can send a signal to the processor saying, hey, some bits were flipped and I couldn't fix it. So memory has some wrong information. And this gets manifested to the operating system as an exception. And this is the sort of exception that our textbook authors call an abort. Because generally, when you get that, if you're the operating system, what you're going to do is either ignore it or like just crash the system saying, I don't know about the state of any data because the memory chip is broken. But for events like that, like our machine is broken, like that's something that will notify the OS of with a type of exception, you know, that our textbook puts in this abort category. Some other sources might call it an interrupt since it's usually asynchronous. I think part of the reason they put it in a fourth category is that aborts can kind of straddle the line between synchronous and asynchronous. So they can be just like our memory chip detected a failure, or it can be that you tried to read from memory and that caused our memory chip to detect a failure. So they like could be triggered by a particular instruction, hypothetically, even though that's probably uncommon. But as I said, these are the least important category because they come up very little in a running system. Obviously, if you're writing an OS, you better implement them because you probably want to at least not have your system do nothing, you know, at all if you detect that your memory chip is failing, because at the least, you want someone to replace that memory chip with one which works. Okay, so any questions about any of these categories of exceptions and why we use them? Except for the lingering issue of why do we want a system call, a trap exception, instead of just making a function call, which we'll get to in a bit. Okay, so let's talk about what we have to do to actually implement exceptions, both in hardware and the operating system. So there are several phases of processing an exception. So one is that somehow something needs to detect the condition. And there are basically two ways this can happen. So one way is that we have our instruction processing logic and we have some control signal, like from our ALU, which says you just divided by zero. So that's pretty simple. You know, it's just like detecting whether a jump is taken when you implement your processor. The other case is we have some external event. So our processor is going to have some physical wires going into it, which can have a voltage on it if there's something for the processor to do. And that's how we're going to detect that. We're going to have something which looks at that value like every cycle and uses it to determine whether I want to fetch the next instruction normally or I want to start going to the OS code. So whenever the processor detects a condition of any sort, it needs to, at the minimum, save the current value of the PC somewhere. And the reason I just say the PC is everything else you could imagine, maybe the OS could figure it out, but if we're going to jump to the OS, we're going to overwrite the PC to do that. And we need to go back to wherever the exception happened. And because it might be an asynchronous exception where who knows where you're running when that timer interrupt happened, the processor needs to save that information or it's going to be lost and the OS will have no idea how to restart the program. So the hardware is going to save the current value of the PC. The OS is probably going to read that value and store it in its memory if it switches away from the program so it can restore it later. But the hardware first needs to save it or else it's just lost forever. Then, once we save the PC, we can safely overwrite it with something else. And so the hardware is going to jump to the exception handler. And this is going to be code inside the operating system. And this is just like a normal jump, except that it's done by the processor, not by the normal jump instruction. It's done by the processor without any instruction precipitating it. It just got this signal, and it says, instead of fetching an instruction, I'm going to do what a jump would do right now. Okay. So one question we have is, okay, we know how we detect the condition. So one question we have is, where do we save the current value of the PC? And another question is, how do we find out where the exception handler is? And for both of these questions, there are multiple good answers used by real processors. So I'm going to describe a simplified version, and our textbook describes a simplified version, compared to what, say, x86 does. So this is one thing we could do. It's not the only possibility. So the first question is, where do we save the current value of the PC? And there are basically two common options. So one option, is save it into memory. And this is what our textbook talks about being done, just like a call instruction does. We're going to have some location in memory where we put it. So the processor can just save it to memory, just like it would save the PC in a call instruction. It's going to save the PC of the instruction that hasn't been executed yet, just like a call to memory. Another option that is also commonly used is into a special register. So we can add a register to our processor that's only used to save program counters during exceptions. And the idea is that the OS then accesses that register, perhaps using some special instructions that only access that register and like copy it to a normal register in order to use that value. So both of these are common options used by real processors. But regardless of which choice we make, we have to save it somewhere. So the most common way to figure out where the exception handler is that we're going to actually want to have multiple exception handlers. And the reason for this is that we want to do something rather different when we find out a program divided by zero versus we had a timer interrupt. And the most common way of letting the OS know which happened is that the OS makes a separate handler for each kind of exception. And the processor looks up in a table in memory where to find each kind of exception handler. So each exception has a number. So in this case, we're saying that exception type 0 is divided by 0, and exception type 8 is going to be timer interrupt. And the processor has this special register called the exception table base register. And there are going to be special instructions to set this register. It's clearly not like a normal register you can move to normally. So there's going to be an extra instruction to set that register to some value. So the OS sets up that register after creating this exception table with pointers to all the handlers it wrote. And typically, these handlers are just going to all start with some code to save a copy of all the registers. And the reason for that is, well, if we had a timer interrupt, the program probably was using RAX for something. We can't change it. This is not like a normal function call where you know the program, you know, is not going to care what you do to say RAX and R8 and R9. We don't have that luxury. Because the timer interrupt could have happened anywhere, we need to, as the OS writers, save all the registers so the program doesn't notice. When we switch back to it, we can't have changed any of its registers. So if we want to use RAX in our timer interrupt handler, we better make a copy of it first. So our basic procedure is the hardware saves the old program counter. Sometimes the hardware might save a bit of extra stuff. This is, you know, something the hardware can do to help the OS, but it's not strictly necessary, right? The only thing that the hardware definitely needs to save is the program counter because it changes it to start the exception handler. The hardware can save some other stuff, and that just makes the OS's job easier. It looks up in the table, jumps there, then the OS saves anything it needs to save, and figures out, what do I want to do if a program divided by zero? It has some policy for that. What do I want to do if a program had a timer interrupt? Has some policy for that, can have its own data structures about like how long has this program run, and so on. Yeah?
Is it possible to say
the question is, if the processor saves the PC to memory, how does it know where it's saved? To memory, so, you know, and this has to be in a, you know, chosen location. So, e.g., OS sets location via register, or e.g., a fixed address, like the same address every time. You know, and there's more choices like that. Or another example would be e.g. on the stack. Like, there's lots of choices, but it just has to be a single defined location, yes. So into memory, like, there's a whole lot of sub-choices if you're storing it in memory. And on x86, what actually happens is it's saved in memory, kind of in a location specified by the OS. It's kind of, basically. Not via a register, but via a register that points to something which has a pointer to a memory location. Which is why I'm not describing what really happens in x86, because there's a lot of indirection which doesn't really matter like that. But yeah, it's not particularly important where in memory it's saved, so long as it's a location the OS can figure out and control in some way. So what we've done to implement our CPU support for exceptions is we've added an instruction to set that exception table base register. So that's a special register. It's not one of the registers we can normally move into. So we have to add a new instruction in order for it to be able to be set. We added some new logic to read the exception table when we detect that condition for an exception and jump there. And some new logic to save that OLPC to that special register or to somewhere in memory before we start writing the OS code, before we forget what the OLPC was and never be able to recover it. So another thing we're going to need is a piece of logic to return from an exception. So we want to jump back to the safe PC in some way. And you might say, well, don't we have instructions that do this? So there's a bit of a complication with it, with using instructions to do this. So, and there's two reasons why we're going to have a dedicated instruction. So first, let's talk about the simple case. So why can't I just do jump RAX to go back to the code? So I just like move from saved PC into RAX, and then jump RAX. Why is that not a choice I'm allowed to do? Why is that, if I'm writing the OS code, and this is how I'm going to finish up my exception handler, why is that a wrong option? Yeah.
RAX might have been important
to the Yeah, so RAX might be used by the previous program. It might be that we stop the program right before an instruction that uses RAX and expects RAX to have the value the program put in it. And if you apply this logic, this is the same thing's going to hold true for every register you can think of. You might say, okay, well, most programs don't use like R14, but maybe it was. So, you know, you just can't do that. So one thing you might say is, well, we do have an instruction which jumps somewhere without using a register, and that's return. And it seems like maybe we could use return. We just push something onto the stack and return. And there are two reasons why that's not going to work. So one is things related to protection, which we'll talk about later. But the other reason is that this kind of breaks the illusion the processor really has its own memory and processor, because the OS doesn't get to know about calling conventions from programs. It's just running it like instruction by instruction. So you, as a program writer, don't have to use the stack in the right way. So yes, the calling convention might say you're not supposed to access memory below the stack pointer, but nothing says you have to obey the calling convention when you might be interrupted by the OS. So the OS needs to take care of that eventuality so it can't just write to your stack and return, because you might be using that memory. You might assume that that memory won't change. And we want, when the OS switches away from your program and switches back, that it should be completely invisible, except timing. Other than timing, it should be completely invisible. There should be no way for you to know, even if you're doing things which violate the calling convention, because, well, it's your code. You can use whatever calling convention you like. So to deal with this, we're just going to have a new instruction for returning from exceptions. So one example of what that instruction could do is it could read from that saved PC special register. Another thing it could do is it could read from the saved memory locate, the place in memory we saved the PC, and jump back there. So that's what the processor does, and that's the processor support for this. So with that processor support, most of our exception handlers are going to have this basic structure. That the first thing every exception handler is going to do is it's going to save the process's state somewhere. Because the processor probably didn't save absolutely everything, so we're going to save any additional state we need to save. Usually there's going to be some, to some well-known location in that the OS deals with. Then we're going to do the actual work to handle the exception. So for example, for a timer interrupt, that work is, do I want to run a new program? We're going to figure out, what program do I want to run next? Is it the same one? Is it a different one? and we're going to make that choice. If it's a keyboard interrupt, we're going to say, what programs were waiting for keyboard inputs? Do I want to run one of them next? We're going to do that logic. Then we restore the state of a program. And in the case of something like a timer interrupt or a keyboard key press interrupt, it may well be a different program than the one whose state we saved. So we saved a program state, we decided, okay, that program was nice, but I have this other program that's now more important. I'm going to run that one. So I'm going to restore that other program's context onto the processor, and we're going to return back to it. So that program previously stopped probably from an exception, and we're going to return, conceptually from that exception into the, even though it was triggered by this timer interrupt. So then we jump back to that program whose state we restored and keep going, waiting for the next exception to happen as far as the OS is concerned. So for example, on a normal timer interrupt, we end up, we do our timer interrupt happens while we're running loop, the processor looks up in the exception table, and eventually we decide, okay, I have this other program I want to run, so I'm going to set the address space to SSH's address space. I'm going to use some special instruction to do that. I'm going to set the save PC to be the one for SSH, and then I'm going to use the return from exception to jump back to that save PC. And that's what the OS does when it switches between programs. So any questions about this? Yeah. So we jump back, we return from the exception, but because we set the save PC to be SSH's, we don't return to loop. We basically change the return address to be for SSH, and also everything else in the context. Okay, so a question you might have is that if this is how exceptions work, what keeps me from doing this? So I have a clever strategy where I have my infinite loop, and I'm really annoyed that I can't really use the CPU on the lab machine. So instead, what I'm going to want to do is I'm going to set my own exception table that's better than the OS's exception table. And the main reason it's better than the OS's exception table is because my timer interrupt handler always decides to just return rather than doing that pesky work of switching to another program. I'm not going to do that. So what's going to happen if I, build this program, presumably using the real instructions, which are not called set exception table, that do this in x86 and try to run it on the lab machines? So I just write this program, with the actual x86 instruction names and so on. What's going to happen when I try to run it? Yeah. Probably crash because I'm not allowed to do that. We have to be in what's called kernel mode. And indeed, that's what happened. So for example, the instruction to set an exception table in x86 is called LIDT, which stands for Load Interrupt Descriptor Table. Not a great name. And if I run that instruction, I get segmentation fault. Sorry. And the idea here is that we just can't let any program do some instructions. We can't let someone change the timer interrupt handler to just always return and never run another program. Because then anyone running on the lab machines could just steal the CPU forever. And this is what allows us to share machines between users. And there's lots of instructions we're going to restrict this way. So setting the exception table is one. We're not going to allow someone else to set a new exception table. Changing the address space is one. We're not going to allow someone else to read the memory of another program. You're not going to look in someone else's text editor and pull out the data. That's not going to be allowed. You can't get an address space which includes their memory. We're not going to allow any program to talk to the I/O device. We're going to have the OS decide who gets to access this part of the hard drive, who gets to talk to the network. And the OS can, for example, keep you from reading other people's files that way. And to implement this, as alluded to by the answer, the processor has a kernel mode, where privileged instructions work, and a user mode, where privileged instructions cause an exception instead. So as a processor implementer, what we need to do is we have an extra 1-bit register, which is, are we in kernel mode? And we're going to set this register in a simple way, which is that exceptions are always going to enter kernel mode. They're always going to set this register to 1. And our return from exception instruction is going to always leave kernel mode. And in this way, we run our normal programs in user mode. And this gives us another reason we want to return from exception instruction. And that's to switch back to user mode, where programs can't do everything that we reserve for the OS to do, like decide whether a program can use the CPU forever. And this is why you might have noticed this part of this picture of program memory, where I have this region labeled used by OS. So you might notice that, we still have to have the OS code somewhere. Like, the exception table still needs to go somewhere, even though it's privileged. So what we're going to do is we're going to put all our exception handlers up here. And that code's going to run in kernel mode, and that's how we're going to do all our handling of I/O operations and so on. Yes?
So is that the same physical address for the exception handler table?
So the question is whether the exception handler table is at. So first of all, these are virtual addresses.
Right. But do they all point to the same physical address?
So typically, this mapping will be the same in every program. So a thing you might ask, though, is, this is where the exception handlers are. Not sure that's used by the OS. What's going to keep the program from actually accessing that memory and changing the instructions? Why can't, I can't change the exception table base register. Why can't I just edit the exception table, which is sitting up in that region of memory? And it has to be in memory because the processor reads the exception table base register and looks up where to go based on it. So the most common solution to this is that our mapping actually doesn't just say that it goes to an address or an error. It says that it goes to an address or an error, or it goes to an address, but only in kernel mode. So another thing we'll use that user kernel mode setting for is we'll decide that certain parts of the mapping only work if we're in kernel mode. So that OS-only region will be memory that, yes, it's in the address space, but it's only going to be accessible when the processor is in kernel mode, which means that we can put all our exception handling stuff there and not worry about the program being able to change it. So I can have my exception table base register point to that memory, and it's mapped. I can use it for my exception handlers, but the normal program can't manipulate my exception table, can't manipulate all the other OS data structures I'm looking at, like my safe registers and so on. And that's safe from the program. And this is, leads us to, this protection mechanism in general. Anytime we try to do something where there's a protection issue, this yields a protection fault. So anytime we do something in kernel mode we're not allowed to do, that's a protection fault. So if we access memory that we don't own, we like try to write a bad address, used by the OS. Yes, that's a protection fault. If we try to access the I/O devices directly, do one of those privileged instructions, we get a protection fault. And what's going to happen on that is the OS gets control. And the primary thing it might do is just say, no, I'm going to kill your program. It could decide to do something else. It could decide to say, you're trying to access an I/O device? Let me do that for you. But the OS gets to decide, and this is how the processor delegates that decision about what to do to the OS. So since we can't do these operations directly here that trigger a protection fault, like trying to write memory used by the OS or accessing I/O devices, we obviously need to be able to do that. And as I alluded to earlier when I talked about reads, this is the big reason we have system calls. So all these privileged operations, all these things which require kernel mode, like accessing the hard drive or accessing the keyboard, we're going to use a system call to get into kernel mode and ask the OS to do something. And because we need to be in kernel mode in order to talk to the IO device, because if we try to do that otherwise, we'll get this fault and the OS will, you know, just learn, hey, your program decided to do something it shouldn't have done. We're going to instead want to make an explicit request to the OS, and we're going to use a trap to do that. So there's these dedicated instructions for asking the OS to do something, and that's what we're going to use. So this means a lot of things. So for example, when we allocate memory, we want to change that address space mapping. We want to have that mapping have an additional entry, which previously pointed to trigger error, we want to point to real memory. We can't set the address space, because if we could, then I could read the OS's memory and write the OS's memory, and that would be very bad. I could like get rid of the timer interrupt handler and run forever. So we have to ask the OS to do that. When reading and writing a file, we can't communicate with the hard drive directly, and we shouldn't be able to, because otherwise I could read and write anyone's files. So we're going to ask the OS to do it. The OS is going to say, do you have access to that file? And if so, it's going to do the read and write for me. Read from the keyboard. The OS is going to decide who's supposed to be reading from the keyboard now. And the way it's going to do that is by only doing it itself on behalf of the programs. So for all these things, we're not going to do the operations ourselves. Instead, we're going to ask the OS to do them by causing code to run in kernel mode using a trap. We're going to deliberately cause the OS to run using an instruction designed to do so, and the OS is going to do this type of operation for us. And this is called a system call. So it's kind of similar to a function call, but we can't use a normal function call for it because we need to be in kernel mode. Because if we just use a normal call, it doesn't change the mode from user to kernel mode. When whatever instruction we call tries to do the privileged thing, it's still not going to work. So we need to have the processor help us and switch to kernel mode. So in 64-bit Linux, I'm going to go through the specific example of what, from the user side of things, a system call looks like. And x86-64 has this special instruction called syscall. And it's an instruction that is a trap. It triggers an exception. And that's the only thing it exists to do. And just like a function call, we're going to have a calling convention for system calls. So we're going to set up our arguments and so on, and then use this instruction to start the system call. Just like for a function call, we set up our arguments and use a call instruction to start a function. And Linux has just chosen a particular calling convention where they said, before the system call, you set REX to a system call number. So for example, you might do something like 0 equals read, 1 equals write, and so on. So you have a number for the type of operation you're doing, and then you use some other arguments, other registers for arguments. So then you run the system call instruction, and the processor combined with the OS together will arrange to return to the instruction after your system call instruction. And when they return, they're going to change the registers so that REX contains the return value of the system call. And on Linux, Linux has a convention for errors from system calls. So most system calls can fail. Like you try to read from a file you don't have open, for example. That's a failing system call. And they use -1 times an error number for that case. Otherwise, they return some other value. So this looks almost the same as normal function calls. The only difference is rather than using call with an address, we use the single system call instruction, which goes to a place specified in the exception table. And it switches to kernel mode. Those are our two differences, is one, where do we find the code to run? Via the exception table. Two, do we run it in normally? No, we run it in kernel mode. Otherwise, same as a normal function call. So for example, this is an hello world program that uses system calls directly. So here I set the system call number to write. I set the out arguments to that to include saying output to file descriptor 1, which means standard out, send the string. And the string is 15 characters, and I make a system call. And when I've set things up that way, that says write hello world to my output. And then I make a system call to exit the program. I have to make a system call for that because I can't get rid of my own program in any other way. The OS has to do it, so something needs to make a system call. And in a normal C program, when you return from main, there's code the compiler provided which called main, which makes the system call for you. But here I'm giving an example where I don't rely on that compiler code which calls main. That's why this is underscore start and not main. And in the OS, when it gets the system call, the typical implementation is you save all the registers, and then you have a table where you have separate handlers for each type of system call. So we look up in the exception table handler, you know, this, the exception table points to this via one of its entries, and this looks up in yet another table to figure out which type of system call is handled in which way. And we have separate code for read, write, exit, and so on. And Linux has system calls for all the sorts of things you imagine the OS needs to do. It has a system call for allocating memory, like I said. When we create a new process, we can't do that ourselves. We can't change the OS's data structures to add a new context, add a new address space, so there's a system call for that. On Linux, it's called fork. There's a system call to run a different program. I can't easily load a new program in my address space. So I just ask the OS to do that for me. It knows how to do it. It does it all the time for terminating a program, for accessing files, and so on. So all these have different types of system calls with different system call numbers. But it's all the same mechanism of starting the OS. And all of these things rely on some sort of privileged operation, so we need to do them in kernel mode, at least partly. And because exceptions are the only way to get into kernel mode, this is how the operating system gets to control what programs can do. So I can run code on the same machine that you're using safely because the operating system has written all its exception handlers to not let other users do things they're not supposed to do. If the operating system makes a mistake anywhere, well, too bad. But by just writing every single exception handler very carefully, the OS can ensure that programs are only allowed to cause things that should happen to happen. So as long as there's no bugs in any of the exception handlers, all the like 25 of them, and then the like 50 system, 100, 200 system call handlers, you won't have a problem. And sometimes there aren't bugs. And otherwise your OS is not secure. But that's what the basis of like our security between users on a modern system is based on. So that the OS, when it writes these exception handlers, makes sure that kernel mode things only happen when they're supposed to. Okay. So a final note about system calls. So usually, when you use system calls, use system calls in a way which looks like a normal function. You like to open some file, you know, right? Like this is what people often refer to as a system call. Like it looks like a function call in C. But clearly, we can't actually have this be a function call in C because we can't use a call instruction to call the real system call. So what the C standard library provides is a lot of wrapper functions. Like here's the one for open. So open has system call number 2 on Linux. And this function just says, I'm going to set the system call number and actually call the syscall instruction. So you write a call to a function called open. And the function called open in the library, all it does is call the system call. So you aren't directly calling the system call, but it's pretty close. And this just has some code to handle to dealing with the error and passing the arguments and so on. And that's all it does. And this is commonly used in something like Linux. There's all these functions which all they do is wrap a system call like this. So when you use that, you'll see code like this, where we open a file using that system call, and we get back a file descriptor, and we check the result. And we're not calling a system call directly, but it's pretty close to it. We're, you know, we just have this translation between our calling convention and the system call calling convention, which are slightly different. Most notably, we need this system call number. Okay, so any questions about this? System calls? Yeah.
Does Windows have a different version of open?
The question is, does Windows have a different version of open? Windows has completely different system calls, yes. Completely different. Same basic idea, but completely different calling convention and set of system calls, and so on. Okay, so a brief note on terminology. So I've used the book's terms for exceptions. The real world is not so nice. The real world often calls interrupts, for uses the term interrupt for all kinds of exceptions, sometimes, but not always. Sometimes they use what our book does, and interrupts only mean things that are asynchronous. Sometimes the word exception only means faults, instead of all types of exceptions that we've talked about. Sometimes aborts go by the name hard fault, and therefore soft faults are what we call faults. Sometimes the word trap is used to mean faults and not system calls like things. Those are called something else. So you'll see all these different names if you like read stuff in the real world. Like if you pick up a processor manual for x86, they call everything interrupts. If you pick up a processor manual for ARM, they'll do something different. Everyone disagrees. I'm sorry, the real world is very bad about terminology. So just keep this in mind if you ever read real documentation about exceptions, that you have to figure out what they mean when they say exception, interrupt, fault, trap, and so on. Because everyone uses different terms. They're usually consistent within themselves. And a processor manual will usually define it somewhere, but you need to look it up. Because they are different. I'm going to just use the book's terms, but I'm just warning you, if you pick up a processor manual, you might be confused. Also, same thing sort of holds true for kernel mode. There are some other terms for kernel mode. At least kernel mode always means the same thing, but sometimes you might hear it called supervisor mode or privileged mode or ring zero. Those all just mean kernel mode. Okay. So any questions about terminology? Okay. So I'm going to briefly, in our last 3 minutes, start out on our next topic, which is about this address translation, this mapping. And as I said, we call the program addresses virtual addresses, and we'll call these real addresses physical map addresses. And as I said, these virtual addresses is everything we access. And these addresses, notably, might be different sizes. So we're not going to require that our mapping goes from, you know, the same number of physical and virtual addresses. This makes sense because the size of our physical memory might vary. But the size of our addresses is defined by how big is our registers. And the typical implementation of this we're going to talk about is this virtual memory. We're going to have a format where we're going to divide up the address spaces, the virtual addresses and the physical addresses, into fixed size chunks. And we're going to call these pages. So here's our toy program memory. So I have a program with 10-bit addresses, 10-bit virtual addresses. Those are the size of the program addresses. I'm going to divide that up into four what I call virtual pages. So each page is a range of addresses. And I'm going to number them just based on their order in addresses. You may notice that the numbering corresponds to these first two bits. That's not a coincidence. I've divided them up, so that's true. So my pages, in this case, are 2 to the 8 bytes, which means if I look at all but the last 8 bytes, I have a page number. So I've numbered each of these pages with the upper bits of the address. And I've divided up my address this way. And I'm going to call the rest of my address a page offset. And what we're going to do is we're going to take whole pages of these virtual addresses And we're going to divide up our physical addresses in the same kind of way. So in this case, I have more physical addresses than virtual addresses. I have more memory than my program can access at a time on my system, so I can run multiple programs, presumably. I'm just going to choose a mapping from one to the other. And I'm going to write down that mapping, and that's going to be what I'm going to call a page table. And this is the kind of format that we're going to use to store that mapping I showed you earlier that determines when I access an address in a program, what am I really accessing? And that's what we're going to talk about for basically the remainder of this class. Okay, so that's what I have for today. Good luck on the lab tomorrow. As a reminder, if you can't make the final, please fill out that form really soon, or else you might have problems.